From the Sky News Centre at 6, a man armed with a knife and wearing a fake explosive device has been shot dead by police after a stabbing on London Bridge. Several people were injured, some seriously. People reported hearing gunshots in the area just before 2 p.m. A video on social media shows members of the public wrestling a large knife from a man before he was shot by armed officers. The Prime Minister has been praising those people who ran towards the danger.
I also want to pay tribute to the extraordinary bravery of those members of the public who physically intervened to protect the lives of others. And for me, they represent the very best of our country.
Assistant Commissioner Neil Basu is the UK's top counter-terror police officer.
It has been declared a terrorist incident. We are working jointly with the City of London Police as we continue to respond. Officers from the Met's Counter-Terrorism Command are now leading this investigation, but I must stress we retain an open mind as to any motive.
Earlier this month, the terror threat level was lowered from severe to substantial. The White House says the UK has its full support. In other news, a man's been told he'll spend at least 33 years behind bars for murdering his heavily pregnant ex-wife by shooting her with a crossbow. The baby boy survived the attack in East London last November. NatWest has apologised after customers reported issues relating to online banking and its mobile app. The company says it's still experiencing some problems on what's payday for many people. Wolves boss Nuno Espirito Santo and Leicester manager Brendan Rodgers are among those being linked with succeeding Unai Emery at Arsenal. He was sacked by the Premier League club this morning after 18 months in charge. And David Pemsel will no longer be joining the Premier League as its chief executive. Allegations about his private life appeared in the media this week. That's the latest. I'm Kat Suave.
The general election is on the 12th of December.
BCFM Radio. This is Bristol. Not London. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Conservative candidate in next May's mayoral election, Samuel Williams. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the US-owned Comcast News at 7, from Russia with Blood, a new book out on the evil Putin, his global hit squads, alleged, that is. And extraordinary developments as French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian announces France may be about to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal, bringing his country into step with just Israel and the United States. That's two of the P5 plus one world powers. Looking like abandoning the JCPOA, which many consider to be the only thing stopping a major Middle East war between Israel and Iran. Germany, Russia, the UK and China remain in the deal with Iran, but France, Germany and Britain, or the European powers. Staying in Paris also, we hear from one of the Yellow Vest spokespeople about how they've been getting on for the last year of protesting against Macron. And for those enjoying our ferreting out of the dirt on Hitler's little-known private secretary and Nazi war criminal who escaped justice, Martin Bormann, more evidence the man who stayed in the shadows was one of the main instigators of the Holocaust and the persecution of Christians and Jews. Last week we heard how he organised the 1C conference on the Final Solution. This week another notorious conference he organised, the Red House meeting 7 months before the end of World War II, where German industrialists agreed tactics to move all their assets overseas in preparation for an underground Fourth Reich. Also, Tory and Labour spending plans for the general election. Are they realistic? That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. com. Tonight, lows of 3 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs around 7, cloudy tomorrow, but sunny spells on Sunday. Next week, highs around 5 Celsius, sunny spells and some light rain at the end of next week. But next weekend, that's the 7th and 8th of December, highs around 7 Celsius with some sunny spells. That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news and talk a bit about the general election campaign is Conservative candidate in next May's mayoral election, Samuel Williams. Hi, Samuel, and welcome to The Politics Show.
Good evening. It's lovely to join you. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. What's your background? What brought you to the Conservative Party?
Yeah, absolutely. What brought me to the Conservative Party? I think in many ways, Cameron's Big Society, if you remember back to Cameron's Big Society, I was working in community development at the time, working to create neighbourhood partnerships and the like, and it was a real challenge, actually, for community work, community development, local politics at the time, and that might seem an odd thing to then join the Conservative Party following that, but I saw an opportunity for communities to come together to be empowered and resourced.
But wasn't the Big Society just a buzzword? It didn't really mean anything.
That was, I think, yes, I think that was the danger. I would look at the Big Society as a fantastic concept and idea that was poorly executed, if I'm honest, and yet the idea of communities, providing contextual programs and projects that engaged in the needs of that local community is the way to move forward with local grassroots politics.
But I mean, at the same time, the Conservatives and the Lib Dems, not just the Conservatives, have been pulling funding away from local authorities. So that ability to do that has been decreasing. In fact, surely there's been less opportunities for local communities to do what they want simply because the funding to the regions is being cut.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not been easy with cuts. Absolutely. I'm not here to pretend otherwise. However, we're also very quick to say funding is the issue. It's always the funding is the issue. I celebrate the announcement of things like the £500 million Youth Investment Fund, various other funds in this manifesto that will be putting money back into local communities and particularly into youth services and supporting libraries and some of these key services that have been cut.
Tell us about that fund then, because first I've heard of it. So what's the plan for this?
Yeah, so it'll be a £500 million fund distributed over the next few years that will be precisely pouring money back into those key services that are so important. Those
so is this coming services, into local authorities, coming to Bristol City Council to spend?
The way in which it will be distributed is yet to be ironed out. But we absolutely will be working with local actors. So it's not only council, but they, as a government, we've agreed to and committed to doing it in negotiation with stakeholders. So it will be local authority, but it will be also youth services, voluntary sector, all of those key stakeholders within communities who know what to do. So the plan will be developed, but the pot of that £500 million has been committed. So that's fantastic news, I think, for those services.
Well, one of the things we've seen is that money from central government hasn't completely stopped coming to the regions. Some of it is still coming to the local authority, obviously. We've still got Bristol City Council's not completely sailed off down the channel. But what seems to be happening is that much of that money is coming to different bodies, like, for example, the local enterprise partnerships. They're spending it. You see, for example, developments that say local enterprise partnerships funded on the side of it. Now, in the old days, it would have been the city council that did that. The city council was democratically elected. Most of this money now seems to be being spent by these unelected bodies that are appointees from, hang on, what I'm saying is almost like the EU. And that's a whole other subject. We've got a new European government coming in every 5 years, it happens, and it's not an election, it's a sort of something completely different. But anyway, so that's the worry for many people will be, well, this money's coming in, but it's not actually coming through a democratically accountable council.
Yeah, and checks and balances have to be in place for this. I mean, that's the simple fact of it.
So why not just give the money to the council? We know we've got councillors there that we elect that will decide and can be lobbied, and we can go and have a chat with them and say, well, what about this project here? Don't you think you should be spending some money on that? If the money's not coming to the council, it's not really anywhere near as accountable the way it's spent, is it?
Well, I think that's debatable, actually. It may not be centrally accountable, but that doesn't mean it's any less accountable. And it also cuts out the bureaucracy and challenges that come with directing everything through a central body and administrative costs that come with that. And we were talking about the locally contextual programmes before. Well, actually, they're only locally contextual and reach the people who need it most if the people who need it most are engaged in the distribution of those funds.
Okay, so you're standing for mayor. Is the mayor a position you agree with? Because it's been quite controversial, the amount of power that's now in the hand. I can remember before there was decided to have a mayor, there was even talk in the Bristol Post, of all places, of it being a dictatorship. And now people are saying, well, actually, this has become rather a dictatorship, and the elected councillors around the city of all parties have almost no say, really, in the way the city's run. The mayor just seems to do what he wants.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some truth in that. And when I'm out knocking on doors and speaking with people and getting to know people, I hear it a lot, actually. People saying, I don't agree with the position. And for me, it's important that we lead and I lead with the ability to do good through that position. It has enabled the streamlining of decision making, which is a positive thing. I think the council admittedly actually was in quite a bind previously and actually wasn't delivering as effective services as it could. So it's helped in that. But absolutely, we have real concerns, and I have real concerns as to whether the might not go so far as to say dictatorship, but certainly an autocratic system that actually means that it's not being run as a democratic system, as
okay.
we hoped.
Now, the Conservatives do stand a very good chance of winning the Metro Mayor position, and some cynical people, not me, of course, would say that actually that's the reason why the area was expanded right out into the leafy suburbs and into Gloucestershire and places like that, that the Metro Mayor was elected and that's been a Conservative. But you, the chances are you're not going to win. You may do, but the chances are you're not going to win. But if you were to, on the outside chance, would you be looking at some sort of cabinet with lots of different parties in there, or would you be solidly wanting Conservatives to run the city?
No, you see, I think that's been the downfall of the current administration, actually, that it's been a very strong Labour cabinet, Labour-run council, and actually we know that diversity in the boardroom and in the cabinet room and across organisations is good for innovation, for creativity, for implementation of positive programmes. And so I would be looking much more towards developing a more of a rainbow cabinet, so to speak, to use that phrase, but certainly a cabinet and a council that represents all people. And I'm really keen to stress at this moment, not just people who are already currently involved in local politics, but actually what does it mean to reach out to and listen to local residents and ensure that they're engaging in the development of services and policy? And that's something that I hear a lot, people feeling unheard, unlistened to and uncared for by the local current administration. That needs to change.
Well, you're in a bit of a difficult sticky wicket, shall we say, as a Conservative campaigning for mayor, knowing that Brexit is one of the biggest issues around. Unfortunately, still, it'd be nice if we didn't have to talk about it, but we do because it's a major issue in the general election. And the city is apparently anti-Brexit, and that's what the referendum result was, very much a Remain result. And yet there you are standing as a Conservative candidate. That's not going to do you any favours, surely.
I think it would be fair to say that the city is divided, actually. You know, I don't think we can just say it's a Remain city. That's certainly not what I hear when I'm out meeting people. There's a real diversity of view. And increasingly, there's the view of people, of Democrats, people who say, look, actually, whatever way I voted, this was the outcome of the referendum. We voted to leave, and now we need to get on with it.
But get on with what? Surely now we're in a position where we don't actually know what we're getting on with, and we really need a second referendum to decide what to do.
I don't agree that we need a second referendum, because then we end up just flip-flopping back and forth and we upset the other side. The polls are still showing a very similar outcome to that 2016 referendum. And so a second referendum, I can't believe, would solve anything on breaking this impasse. However, we need to absolutely start engaging with what it means to bring the city together, but what it means to bring the country together as we move on. So you're right to call me on using that phrase, get on with it, because I think that's unhelpful, actually. And we hear it a lot. And we hear a lot of these sort of hyperbole in politics at the moment, don't we, that is more polarizing than anything else. And so we don't need to just get on with it, but we need to engage with the nuance, engage with views, and start an honest, grown-up conversation about how we move on when the country is so split about these big issues like Brexit.
So, Martin, your party is thinking about, the Labour Party is thinking about having a second referendum, and if it does have a second referendum, it will be either Jeremy's deal or Remain. So where does that leave the majority in the country, who may not be a majority anymore, but certainly a few years ago, that voted to leave?
I think the position's quite clear. If we have a second referendum, there will be a leave option and there will be a remain option, and we will see what people want to do. And I think that's the way to do it, because it wasn't clear exactly what people were voting for in 2016. There will be a deal on the table. You see,
will we still be in the customs union? Will we still be will we still be under the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice?
I think it's quite likely that any deal that Jeremy Corbyn does as a prime minister of probably a coalition government, it looks like, if he manages to get there, will be a Norway style deal. In other words, you'll leave the European Union's infrastructure, but you'll still be in the single market and the customs union. Now, I think that to me, I can live with that. But I think a no-deal Brexit, where we crash out and become Singapore on Thames and all the rest of it, and do deals with Trump about the NHS and so on, which has obviously come into the election campaign in the last week or so, that's not acceptable to me, and I don't think it's acceptable to the majority in the country.
Okay. No, and of course the NHS is not for sale, and that's all we've heard again and again and again, and yet it keeps coming up. The NHS is for sale, or insinuations that it is, which is absolutely not.
Yeah, but the Americans think it should be.
Well, I want to talk about the NHS a little bit later, before that, Samuel, can you just tell us your professional background? What sort of qualities do you bring to the potential for leadership? Where have you been working?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I started off life, like I said earlier, working in community development a lot, working with both charities and faith group organisations, working a lot with churches as well, but all about grassroots community development. I then went on and started a company, and was running a company called Hodos. It's a communications firm doing everything from speech writing through to branding and marketing. And
whose speeches were you writing?
I shouldn't say. But I will tell you one thing. I found myself...
Theresa May?
A number of years ago, I'm going to push on, a number of years ago, where we just finished a large marketing campaign, and the MD of the company came to us and said, Samuel, will you help me promote, advertise, develop a script and narrative for this next product I need to sell? But this is the problem. This product is prohibitively expensive. It serves no real purpose, and in fact, I think it's actively bad for you. And I stood there in that very fancy boardroom and thinking, wow, this is not what I got into business for, because I'm convinced that business can and is a force for good in the world, and I can't continue in that way. So the company's still running, and I have an MD running it, but I took a step away from the day-to-day, and I'm now based with Christian Aid, developing something called the SALT Business Network. And now I work with CEOs, directors of companies across the country, and indeed some across the world, looking at what it means to develop a sustainable Sustainable Development Goal aligned business. So I work with them doing that.
Okay, so most Christian organisations, including Christian leaders, mm-hmm. would point the finger at the Conservative Party, austerity, universal credit, as being one of the great ills of the modern society. So doesn't sit very comfortably with the party that's instigated all those, working with Christian Aid and people like that.
Yeah. I disagree, actually. I disagree because I think that's a misunderstanding of the Conservative Party and Conservative ideology. Now, you know, I think we need to be able to engage in nuance. I think we need to be able to exist in a world where just because we hold a certain view or we are part of a certain party doesn't mean that we agree with everything that has been done within that party. You know, like I said, I've worked with the church and different church organizations over the years, and one of those would be the Church of England. I was almost ordained as an Anglican vicar.
Sounds like Marvin.
But
not an Anglican.
But you see, the thing is, actually, if you look at the Church of England throughout its history, it's full as a religious institution of questionable behavior, and that I could not agree with, of course not. And actually, we've lost the ability to do that, I think, so often in society, where just because we're part of a party doesn't mean we agree with everything. So yes, you're absolutely right that actually austerity has been awful, actually, for many people. It's made life very difficult for many people. It's also enabled the economy to come into a place that we can start to invest and support local communities again. And so, actually, it's not all bad, and we need to learn to work beyond the polarized politic, I think, and accept that, okay, there's some negative here, there's some bad, there's some hurtful stuff, there's some difficult things, but there's also a huge amount of good. And for me, the philosophy of empowering individuals and communities to care for themselves, develop locally contextual programs, is a positive thing and is a thoroughly conservative thing too.
I mean, most of the churches that run food banks would point the fingers at the Tories as well. They'd say, well, look, the reason that we've got the queues of hungry people is the Conservative Party.
They may indeed do that, but I think I would reiterate the point that is a misunderstanding of what being a conservative is about.
Sounds to me like you're almost trying to change things from the inside, which is a perfectly reasonable position. Anyway, let's look at the polling this week in the general election. The latest on Britain Elects 6 hours ago, Conservatives running along at 42%, Labour at 34%, up 2%, Lib Dems 13%, minus 1%. The Brexit Party at 4%, which is plus 1%. They seem to have been sort of disappearing down the scales as the number of candidates have fallen. And the Green Party is at 3%. That's plus 1%. Martin, be frank, it's not looking good, is it, for Jeremy Corbyn? We've 2 weeks to go, and he's between 10 and 8 points behind the Tories.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, the first past the post system, which I oppose, actually.
Well, but we're not talking about the system; we're talking about the result.
But the result the result's going to be very difficult to call because under first past the post, it's constituency by constituency which will determine it, and it's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. I mean, obviously, the fact that we're up a couple of points is encouraging, but what we seem to be doing is squeezing the Liberal Democrat vote. I think there's pretty strong polarisation going on. The Brexit Party have collapsed, and their vote's going to Boris Johnson and the Tory Party.
Well, they're actually up 1% this week.
Well, the Brexit Party obviously have got, you know, they've got a residual. I mean, we've obviously had lots of their people on over the last few months, and a lot of them are quite annoyed about being taken off the. They're not allowed to stand.
It was interesting to see Question Time, for example, last night with nobody from the Brexit Party. One of the, I think it was a Channel 4 debate, nobody invited from the Brexit Party. But the real clanger really was Boris Johnson not turning up for debates. I mean, it sounds like he's frightened to debate because he knows that after every debate, the Conservative vote goes down a little bit, Samuel.
Firstly, my understanding is Nigel Farage was invited and didn't turn up either. And indeed, they both Boris Johnson and then Nigel Farage were faced with this empty chairing, which is a deeply questionable behaviour, I think, probably. And presented with this melting block of ice, which was fairly partisan, wasn't it? I think, and making a very clear.
I think there's some complaints into Ofcom about that now. Anyway.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I don't think Boris Johnson is afraid to debate. No, I don't think he is. And I think as you look across the wider media, he's engaging in multiple radio interviews. He was on LBC this morning, and he's engaging in interviews. He's engaging in all of that.
But he doesn't want to face Corbyn, does he? Not on live television.
Well, I don't know. The polls you've just shown, firstly, he did.
Andrew Neil. Andrew Neil's another one he doesn't
want to
face.
Polls you've just shown is maybe he doesn't need to face Corbyn. It already looks like the polls are showing the direction that we're moving, so which is a strong victory for the Conservative Party.
Martin?
I think there's quite a possibility even now of a hung parliament. There's still 14 days to go or whatever. We were further behind this stage last time. And, of course, the election campaign, there's lots of undecided people. Yeah, there's a whole lot of people out there who basically are not very happy about the choice they're being offered. So I think there's something to play for. I think, ultimately, the whole Brexit saga, we need to move to a different kind of... I'm a strong supporter of changes in the electoral system, because if we had the Brexit people who've been on here, they get frustrated because they feel that they don't get a voice. And, of course, the same thing happens in the Labour Party, because we have to carry a huge, broad church with us within... You know, and, of course, there's a huge spread of views within that. And, of course, other European countries, Ireland, Denmark, Scotland, Wales...
But that's they've got a different way of doing things. It's not going to happen this time, and the last time there was a vote on it, people didn't vote for it. So certainly I can see how it's a maturing of our electoral system, but it simply isn't going to happen this time.
Not immediately.
Anyway, so still on talking about the EU, it's been delayed by a month. There's not really been reported this much anywhere, but the new European Commission is about to start up, as is the new chairman of the European Council, about to take over for another five-year term. Now, I'm going to test both of you two. Now, we've got two major people in the EU. We keep seeing one is Jean-Claude Juncker, and the other one is Donald Tusk. Each of those two is going to be replaced by one of Charles Michel, who's the former Prime Minister of Belgium, who was booted out back in February in a no-confidence vote, but he's now being put in charge of one of those, and Ursula von der Leyen. So, I don't know, maybe I should ask you first, Martin. Do you know which is replacing which? So we've got Charles Michel and Ursula von der Leyen. Who is replacing Juncker and who is replacing Tusk?
I think von der Leyen's replacing Juncker, isn't she? Am I guessing? I might be wrong.
Absolutely right.
Well,
I know. So, yeah, Charles Michel's replacing Tusk. Anyway, so Juncker is the president of the European Commission, which is effectively the government of Europe. The president of the Commission has been referred to many times in the past, and some say should be referred to as the president of Europe. Only one problem: she's not elected, she's appointed. The European Parliament do have scrutiny, and she just about managed to squeak in with MEPs saying, yes, okay, she can take up the job. Anyway, I thought it'd be interesting, since they're just about to start their new jobs a month late, because a whole load of people were appointed to these jobs who were then rejected by MEPs and they couldn't bring them in at the right time. So let's have a listen now to the voice of the new President of Europe, just about to start her job, President-elect Ursula von der Leyen.
Over the next 5 years, our union will embark together on a transformation which will touch every part of our society and of our economy. And we will do it because it is the right thing to do, not because it will be easy. If there's one area the world needs our leadership, it is on protecting our climate. This is an existential issue for Europe and for the world. How can it not be existential when 85% of people in extreme poverty live in the 20 countries most vulnerable to climate change? How can it not be existential when we see Venice underwater, Portugal's forests on fire, Lithuania's harvests cut by half because of droughts? This has happened before without any question, but never with that frequency and with that intensity. And we do not have a moment to waste anymore on fighting climate change.
So that's Ursula von der Leyen there. She's taking over from Jean-Claude Juncker as the president of the European Commission. Climate change is obviously a priority. She seems to be showing real leadership, Samuel. Why do you want out of this club, assuming you do?
Well, she does seem to be showing real leadership, absolutely. And we need to be showing strong leadership, irrespective of this is not a European issue, this is not an EU issue, this is a global issue, this is a local issue, and it's something that strong leadership needs to be shown across the board. So actually, for me, this is not a question of Britain leaving the European Union. This is a question of being strong in leading into a new sustainable world, this new world that we live in, where climate is unavoidable anymore. I was in Bangladesh last year visiting some projects that I've been supporting, and to see communities there, over a million people still recovering from the impacts of Cyclone Ila, which happened in 2009, but still rebuilding there. And speaking with a colleague who was out there just last week, said they started to be able to develop the programs, and then another cyclone rolled in. So this is an existential crisis that we're all in.
So if we're out of the EU and in the arms of the Americans, then climate change is some conspiracy theory, and we won't be paying any attention to it at all.
Well, I certainly hope not. Certainly that's not what we've seen from the Conservatives so far. You know, we've led the world actually in many instances. We've been firm on in the manifesto with pledges moving forward, reaching net zero by 2050. We're world leaders in offshore wind, and millions, billions actually pledged to various different climate related programs. I mean,
it's a great pity, isn't it, the Conservatives decided not to go ahead with the tidal barrage project in Swansea, or Cardiff Bay rather. These sorts of things are surely the future. Why not just get on with them?
Certainly, although $4 billion has been pledged for flood defences in the manifesto, and so they're taking these issues really seriously. And this is why, I mean, it brings us back to that question you asked earlier of why Prime Minister Johnson didn't appear on the debate, the climate debate on Channel 4 last night. We as the Conservatives have got extraordinarily good policies and have been leading the world in climate-related
stuff. So why is he afraid to tell the world that, then?
I don't know. He should have been very proud standing up there to share the work that we've been doing.
Okay, well, before we hear from Charles Michel, the former Belgian Prime Minister, who's replacing Donald Tusk as the chair of the European Council. Actually, no, we'll hear from them now. We'll hear from Martin after we've heard from Charles Michel.
Across Europe, there are 8 political groups in the European Parliament, 24 official languages, and 50,000 different beer brands. So I should feel right at home in my new job. It certainly won't be boring. We are a union of 28 democracies with open debates, political parties, and free press, where we are able to have open discussions and disagreements. For me, this is not a sign of weakness. It is a sign of strength. As long as we are able to agree on the most important thing, to stand together, unified for our common good, and putting labels on people doesn't help either. When I speak to people across Europe, they don't say, I am an elite or I am a populist. They say, I care about my family. I care about my job. I care about my future. I believe we all want the same things. It is how we get there that matters.
That's Charles Michel, and he's replacing Donald Tusk, Martin.
Well, I mean, both of them are actually conservative politicians, I understand. you know, they would be in our terms.
But it's worth saying, isn't it? Yeah. Ursula von der Leyen was the defence minister in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, they're both conservatives because they, you know, that's the dominant strand in the European Parliament and European politics. Well, I think also what you've got in Europe, in Switzerland, and which isn't part of Europe, but in Germany and Austria, which are part of the European Union, you quite commonly have what they call grand coalitions between the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats, because there's a lot of common ground, and it's normal. Of course, the left wing, the Social Democrats don't like that very much, and there's a far right that doesn't like that either. But they're used to forming coalitions. It's just normal stuff, as in Ireland. For example, you know, coalition is normal politics there. And I think Britain is just too, I mean, I think we could probably agree about this, Britain's just too confrontational. I used to work for CAFOD.
Yeah.
And, there's actually lots of common ground, which we can't actually make much of because of the way the trench warfare works in Ulster.
So we better have just a one-party state?
No, well, the problem with having coalitions and so on is that you do end up with a sort of, people think that they can't change anything because it's always the same guys, you know, because it just keeps coming round and round again, you know, so Tweedledum and Tweedledee, like Fianna Gael and Fianna Fáil in Ireland, you know.
Well, the way I've heard it described is whoever's in charge of the ship, it's still going the wrong way.
Well, the point is, what's the direction of travel, isn't it? The real underlying thing is in 2008, we had plenty of Tories coming on the show saying we're all in this together, we're going to have to change our attitude because the financial system, which we've bigged up for years and years and years, has turned out to be an absolute mess. And there was a general understanding that sacrifices were going to have to be made, and people were going to have to pull together to try and sort it out. But of course, what subsequently happened is we've got back into the trenches, and the people that, you know, basically the financial services sector. If you're going to follow, we're going to talk about this in the second hour with Steve Keane. If you're going to follow the free market von Mises Institute playbook, then you let the banks collapse. That's what you do. But if you don't do that and you bail them out, the follow-on from that is that the allocation of resources beyond that is not a market allocation of resources. Yeah? Because you've basically bailed the banks out, which means bailing out the wealthy classes and their assets. And that's why there's been a lot of bitterness about people at the bottom end being take all the pain, when the people at the top basically have walked away not only scot-free, but because of quantitative easing and so on, their asset values have risen.
This sounds like second hour stuff when we're chatting to Steve.
No, but I think it's important to remember, this is the context for the general election. And of course, Cameron, when he first came along, seemed to get this.
Yeah. Well, also the context, another part of the context for the general election is what's been happening in France, because the French are generally much better organised socialist grassroots trade unionists and a bigger tradition of doing this sort of thing. And they're seeing enormous changes there, really, I suppose, catching up with countries like Britain that have privatised quite a long time ago. And so I spoke to one of the yellow vests, his name's Thibault Devienne, about this is a longer interview on Dialect next Tuesday at noon, but this is a little extract from it. What he's saying is that the demands of some very good basic demands, which present really a united front for reform right across Europe, but the one that he focuses on is referenda. He points out that the British referendum seems to be being ignored, the French referendum on the European Constitution was ignored in France, and the referendum in Catalonia has also been ignored. So the idea is, when the people speak, the elites overrule what they do. And this is one of the things that's bringing a lot of people out onto the streets in France. So let's have a listen now to a little extract from the interview with Thibault Devienne, yellow vest from Paris.
The yellow vest movement didn't start, and like most, you know, you hear about demonstrations in France over time. That's one of the original aspects of a French yellow vest. It was born out of anger, it was born out of despair, it was born out of misery. And it started more as a global, let's say, protest without any specific political aims than, you know, an organized movement with a leader, with a perspective, with a full-on program. And from this base, the Yellow Vest evolved, weeks after weeks, months after months, building sort of a list of things to obtain top, you know, advanced ID is the what's known in France as the RIC, which is the direct referendum from the people. We've been, you know, last referendum to happen in France was in 2005, it was the French people stood against at the time. It was about the EU, the French people stood against the Rome meeting. And of course, they were denied in 2008 by President Sarkozy. They were denied a decision despite them voting against it.
Okay, this is the EU constitution, I think, isn't it? And then it's interesting because they framed it as the EU constitution, many countries had plebiscites on it, or referenda on it. And then it came back again as something called the Lisbon Treaty, because a treaty doesn't have to have a referendum, even though actually the text of it was pretty much the same. So what happened in 2005? Was that result rejecting the constitution, was that just ignored by the government?
At the time, no, of course. The government had no choice, but to go with what the French people had decided. But as you mentioned, yeah, the Lisbon Treaty in 2000, which came in fruition in 2008, which is exactly the same treaty, and it's not me talking about it. Actually, previous French president Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, which was a founder of one of the founders, at least, of the European Parliament, said that on a national radio in France, and everybody went with it. So last time there was a referendum in France, my point is, last time there was one in France, it was completely denied. So one of the main remarks, one of the main wishes of these protests, Yellow Vest protests now, has been to implement into the constitution directly the possibility to have, to choose a law from the people, by the people, without going through parliament, without going through, because a few referendums that we indeed had in France were chosen by the government.
So, Martin, I wonder if you think this is regressive or progressive. It's called the RECH, he calls it. Well, I mean, that's my horrendous French pronunciation, which is actually RIC, Referendum Initiative Citizens, and they want this integrated into the French constitution. I suppose the only place I can think of which does this now is Switzerland, actually. They're trying to move things on in France.
Yeah, well, I think the Yellow Vest movement, some people want that, but it's a very broad movement, and it started off with basically economic demands, if you remember.
It was over a increase in fuel tax.
Yeah. So I'm not a big fan of referendums, I'm afraid. I think I'm a
We noticed that.
I think sometimes you have them, but one of the problems we've had is we haven't got a constitution with a referendum bit in it. So when we have one, we don't know what to do with it when we've finished it. And
so you think there should be a sort of political class that decides all these things?
If you go
the idea is that the people are stupid.
Well,
they
if
really
you
know.
Go downtown, you will see the statue of Edmund Burke, who was a founder of conservatism in this country, and he basically justified representative democracy, made the class of defence of representative democracy. He said, I was elected to be the MP for Bristol, and in my judgment, slavery is wrong.
Yeah, but he party,
and of course,
his party,
the people who voted for him didn't agree with that.
Martin, his party kicked him out, didn't he?
He did, yes.
He stood
right.
One term.
Yes,
so,
I know, but I mean, the point is, we have there is a case for representative democracy. The problem with having referenda is that the people are being asked all the time to do, in Switzerland, when you have a referendum in Switzerland, the people who lose go away and try and have another referendum to overturn the first referendum. It's a referendum system.
You mean a bit like Labour Party?
Well, it's a bit like, if you're going to have a referendum system, that's what it looks like, yeah? The others, the losers don't say, well, they're going to accept that. They say, no, we're going to overturn it. And that's what goes on.
Anyway,
it's a referendum.
Samuel, what do you make of this? This proposal from the French, I quite admire them in that they seem to sort of try and take things on and say, well, actually, we're fed up with the government deciding what's important and what's not important. We want the citizens to be able to put forward proposals and vote on them, bypass the government in a way.
I mean, for me, it's not about bypassing the government, but it's about having a government that listens, that actually listens to the people, because we're all people within this state, and actually sharing those views.
So how come they've ended up with Macron? They say this guy is an imposter. He shouldn't be there. He's just kind of crept in.
Well, Macron got elected because what you've got in France is you don't have a proportional system, but you have a two-stage system. So for all electoral posts in France, you vote on the first Sunday for what you really want, and on the second Sunday to keep out the people you don't want. So everybody voted for Macron to keep out Le Pen. Yeah, the left voted for Macron because the alternative was Le Pen. And that, therefore, he came to power with a lot of resentment about him being president from the get-go, because lots of people voted for him just to keep Le Pen out. And this is the, at least the French system allows two goes. Yeah, what would be much better. I mean, in places, other European countries, they have referendums and they also have proportional representation and a written constitution. Norway.
And what's the point of
place.
Having a referendum if you then just ignore it and want
another
one?
What your constitution says, doesn't it? Well, I mean, the point is you've got to have. We haven't got a written constitution, which means that everybody can argue. I mean, the Scots are saying, "Well, we didn't vote to leave." Northern Irish are saying, "Well, we didn't vote to leave." So we're talking about the breakup of the UK here. The Catalonians want to leave Spain but stay in the EU.
Okay.
Are they going to be allowed to do that?
I'll let you have the final word on this, Samuel. Referendum, bad or good idea?
Referendum, bad or good idea? Referendum allowing the people to decide how their state looks like is, of course, a good idea. But like Martin's saying, we have a representational democracy that actually we need our politicians also to be listening well, properly, authentically, and representing that with integrity in the houses. And I'm not saying we don't have that, but you know what? Sometimes I fear our politicians are not listening to their constituents as much as they ought to be, and peddling maybe personal views over what their constituents have said. Well, we need politicians who humble themselves to listen.
Well, he wants to be the Prime Minister, but Jeremy Corbyn is not listening, apparently, to the Jewish community. This week we hear he's refusing to apologise to British Jews after the chief rabbi's anti-Semitism criticism. Samuel, what do you make of this? This is the chief rabbi, Ephraim Mervis, saying that Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite and he's running an anti-Semitic party now because he's in charge.
Yeah, and I find it deeply worrying that Jeremy Corbyn can't simply apologise for the state of that party. You know, the only two have been parties have been reviewed like this, them and the BNP. And he should be able to, in my view, Jeremy Corbyn should be able to accept there is failings, apologise for them, and then give clear direction how changes are going to be made to make that party one that accepts people from all backgrounds. It seems there's a real issue with anti-Semitism.
Well, it seems like a reasonable request, Martin. Jeremy Corbyn's faced a string of questions following Ephraim Mervis's comments, calling the Labour leader's claims to be tackling anti-Semitism as a mendacious fiction and alleging a new poison sanctioned from the very top has taken root in the Labour Party.
Well, this rabbi represents Orthodox Jews, which are about 28% of the community. And if you look at his
political... Well, there are all sorts of... Hang on, just a minute. There are different sorts of Orthodox Jews.
And of course, he's on the record as supporting the attacks on Gaza last year. He's on the record as being in favour of the moving of the capital of Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He's on the record of the annexation of the Golan Heights, all of which is completely against international law. I was an aid worker in Bosnia during the 1990s, and when we went to war with the Serbs, because they insisted that they had to have Kosovo, and we bombed for 73
days.
It's
got nothing to do with anti-Semitism.
It's not anti-Semitic to oppose the racist policies of the Israeli government, which is where Jeremy Corbyn's coming from. And there's been far too much apology and far too much crawling around the place. He's a conservative rabbi and very much behind the right wing in Israel. When we went to war with Syria...
Why is he saying, Martin, just a minute, why is he saying it's a mendacious fiction that Labour leaders claims to be tackling anti-Semitism?
I think we've given far too much ground on this from the get-go. As I say, I was an aid worker in Bosnia in the 1990s, and when Srebrenica happened and all the rest of it, we went to war with Serbia. You know who didn't support us when we went to war with Serbia? The right-wing government in Israel, because they realised immediately that a precedent was being set.
Okay.
Now, if you're going to have people land-grabbing in the 21st century, it's a war talk. It's a
but
war
here,
talk.
He should be able to apologise, I think.
No, he's not. Why should he apologise for something
Martin,
he hasn't
Martin,
done?
just let Samuel ask his question, please.
Well, my question is, irrespective of what Jeremy Corbyn feels about something, there is clearly a significant injured party, so to speak, here, that are saying we feel ostracised, undermined, racially attacked, ethnically attacked within this party, and it's systemic.
And Martin, just
for an apology.
Can I just add to that? In an interview with Andrew Neil for the BBC, Mr. Corbyn was confronted with several statements made by Labour Party members, including one who suggested the number killed in the Holocaust was wrong and asked if they were anti-Semitic. Are they?
People who question the Holocaust are clearly anti-Semitic, but this issue is about the State of Israel and its policies. Don't forget, the State of Israel and international law should be in the boundaries of 1948, just as Serbia can't control Kosovo, they can't control the West Bank, and the Indians can't control Kashmir. These are political issues. We went to war with Serbia, we killed 10,000 people, and they didn't get Kosovo.
Okay.
But the thing who didn't back that, the Israeli government didn't back that, because they knew very well what was at stake.
Okay.
And they were next in line.
Okay, so there was another letter actually sent to the Labour leader. This is from European Jews, which was actually supporting his position. But that wasn't reported, even though these were also Orthodox Jews. Bizarre. And there was also material on the internet, fake news, being circulated, saying that this was a fake document. In fact, it wasn't. It's a completely genuine document. And some Orthodox Jews do support people like Jeremy Corbyn and with his views on Israel. So let's have a listen now to one of those people who is, what is his name? Rabbi Shapiro, and he's an Orthodox Jew. He would counter Ephraim Mervis from the UK, who's the chief rabbi here in Britain. He would counter his point of view, but he's also, of course, Jewish and a rabbi.
Peter Beinart. You know Peter Beinart? Peter Beinart is a very modern Orthodox Jew, kind of a Zionist, but a very liberal Zionist. He's against the occupation and very moderate as far as Zionism is concerned, but he considers Israel, you know, the Jewish state. And he had Deborah Lipstadt on his podcast. Deborah wrote a book about anti-Semitism. She's some expert, according to Zionists, on the topic. And Beinart asked Lipstadt whether ultra-Orthodox Jews, like the Satmar Hasidim, for example, who comprise, they number in the hundreds of thousands, the largest Jewish sect in the world, because they're anti-Zionist, are they anti-Semites? Now, these are ultra-Orthodox Jews. They existed before the State of Israel existed. And Deborah Lipstadt said, well, the jury is out on that. Meaning we are beginning to be branded as anti-Semites, too. What's happening is that Israel is stealing, appropriating the spirit of the Jews, so to speak, such that your attitude towards Israel is your attitude towards the Jews. Whether you're an anti-Semite has nothing to do anymore with whether you hate Jews. It has to do with whether you hate Israel. If you are a philo-Semite, whether you like Jews, has nothing to do with whether you like Jews. It has to do with whether you like Israel. Therefore, you have a guy like Ann Coulter, for example, who tweets terrible things about Jews, but a guy like Ben Shapiro tweeted about her, well, you know, her tweets about Jews are terrible, but since she's pro-Israel, so I'll sleep at night. So you could like not like Jews, but if you like Israel, you're not an anti-Semite, you're a friend of the Jews, and vice versa. If you don't like Israel, but you like Jews, then you're an anti-Semite. Somebody like Mehdi Hassan, for example, who doesn't have an anti-Semitic cell in his body, but he doesn't like Zionism because of political reasons. Many people refer to him as an anti-Semite. And this is sick. Israel is becoming like the voodoo doll, so to speak, of Jewish identity, such that your attitude towards Israel becomes your attitude towards the Jews. The Jews aren't Jews anymore. Israel is the Jews.
So that's countering the views of Ephraim Mervis, the chief rabbi, and that was Rabbi Yaakov Shapiro from the US, who's really aligned with this letter from the European Jews this week. So a bit complicated situation. What do you still think that Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite, or do you think he is? And which side do you go on this? Orthodox Jews have got different points of view. Some think that Corbyn is, and some think he's the complete opposite of anti-Semite.
Look, for me, I think it's a huge issue with many moving parts, and I think we need to be able to understand that, and our political
rhetoric. Discourse at the moment doesn't understand nuance very well. It's very shouty, usually set on broadcast. And that's really not helpful. And going and throwing rocks and pointing fingers, calling this person an anti-Semite, this person not, is sometimes unhelpful. However, if somebody, if a party, if a group of people are saying systematic attitude, belief, approach is being shown towards them, then that should be listened to. So Martin said earlier this is not an anti-Semitic issue. It's a political one. You know, I would say it's one of leadership too. Because actually for me, a good leader is able to listen, understand, and doesn't see it as weakness to apologise, accept responsibility. And that's what Jeremy Corbyn is not doing, which he absolutely should be.
Well, I mean, Rabbi Meir Weinberger, who's written this letter from United European Jews, Martin, actually says, please note we totally reject and condemn in no uncertain terms remarks of the chief Rabbi Mervis, which does not represent the views of mainstream Charedi Jews that live in the UK.
Well, that's right, because of course Jews.
But why
are,
hasn't this been?
Jews
report-
are not.
Why
Jews
hasn't
are
this been reported?
A homogenous group with a homogenous political view.
My question is: why has this debate within Judaism not been reported? Just the chief rabbi.
Well, if you remember, the Al Jazeera did the sting on the Israeli embassy, where the Mossad guy was caught talking to camera, saying, "We've got £1 million."
He wasn't talking to Orthodox Jews, was he?
No, he was. They were talking to Labour MPs at the time, who subsequently jumped ship. But they were. But Al Jazeera caught them on camera saying, "We've got £1 million to spend to get rid of Corbyn and to steer the Labour Party in the direction you want it to go." Now there is anti-Semitism, people having hostility to Jews across, you know, it's there in society and we condemn it absolutely, but we're not going to be told to shut up about very important political issues, war and peace issues. We're not going to war with Iran for Israel.
Okay,
and we're not going to recognise Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
Okay, anyway,
to
wind up tonight, Samuel, I thought I'd ask you about somebody that's almost certainly never going to vote Conservative. This is someone who's homeless and a squatter. So I thought we'd be interesting to hear from one of them to see about the use of property in the city. And if you can just respond to that very quickly afterwards, I'd appreciate it. So this is a guy called Graham, who's just been interviewed for a documentary coming out soon by some of the film students in the city, talking about wanting to get into empty buildings.
The thing that pisses me off the most about homelessness, to be honest, is when I walk around at night time and I see all the buildings empty. Took over the building, still not been used. They took to court, it was a commercial premises.
Oh, okay.
So Section 41, it said that we want to retain our property, but it's still not being used. The agreement, like, yeah, you lot can stay here, keep it clean, or whatever, for as long as possible, but we're coming back in, say, 6 months.
Well, he's never going to vote Conservative. He's very much sort of, I would say, probably anarchist or somebody like that. But what have you got for somebody? I mean, he's a basic, brilliant, brilliant point he's making. Loads of empty buildings, and it's better that we're in there rather than we're sleeping out on the streets.
Yeah, you know, I think what's best for many people who are out having to sleep rough on the streets is that they have a safe place to sleep, warm with the needs. And that's why you've played this and it's broken my heart, really, because homelessness and rough sleeping is at the centre of the work that I'm trying to do and will be the centre of my work.
You've got 10 seconds to explain what you're doing.
So therefore, we will be looking at how we can repurpose buildings, how we can get new buildings built, partnering with organisations like Green Pastures, who are building homes for homeless.
Okay, well, thanks to our guest, Conservative candidate in next May's mayoral election, Samuel Williams. Join us after the US-owned Comcast News at 7 as we take our weekly look around the world. Thanks very much, Samuel.
Thanks.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.